The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us online, danproftshow.com, where you get details, podcasts. You can also get our podcasts at the normal places, iTunes, Spotify. On social media, at Dan Proft Show, as well as at Dan Proft, Facebook and Twitter, at Proft Dan on Instagram. Appreciate that. You can always get my musings and additional content that we don't have time to cover during the program. And appreciate you sitting in for another installment. Everybody knew in early January. Boy, Joe Scarborough over there at Morning Joe and MSNBC, he's real exasperated because everybody knew in early January and President Trump dithered. And that's why we have the number of cases and the number of deaths that we have today. Everybody knew, as Joe Scarborough argued in setting up his interview with Dr. Zeke Emanuel.
Nobody could have seen this coming. The fact is, everybody saw this coming. Everybody saw this coming in early January.
Everybody did. This is important because the revisionist history, that initiative is fully underway on the left to ignore not just the last 90 days, not just the last administration, but the last two decades of reports on what a federal preparedness for a pandemic would look like. As we've discussed in some detail on the show, we'll discuss in more detail a little bit later in the show with a retired Air Force Colonel Randy Larson. Everybody knew. Is that right? A couple of writers over at National Review, our friends Jim Garrity and David Harsanyi, put together good pieces on this. Jim Garrity, providing a great timeline of the lies and obfuscations that form the cover-up by the Chinese communists. December 31st, remember, everybody knew, early January. December 31st, the Wuhan Municipal Health Commission declares the investigation so far has not found any obvious human-to-human transmission and no medical staff infection. This was, in fact, the opposite of the belief of the doctors working on patients in Wuhan, and two doctors were already suspected of contracting the virus at that time, but everybody didn't know. Mm-hmm. Everybody didn't know. January 14th. We're getting past early January when everybody knew. January 14th, the World Health Organization repeated the Chinese propaganda as they're wont to do. No clear evidence of human-to-human transmission of the novel coronavirus. January 14th. So does the everyone who knew include the Chinese government, whose propaganda Scarborough always shares otherwise as reliable data? It's a good question that David Harsanyi raises. January 21st, the CDC announces its first case of coronavirus in Washington State, a resident who was returning from China 6 days earlier. By this point, as Jim Garrity points out, millions of people have left Wuhan carrying the virus all around China and into other countries. But everybody knew that. Did they? January 22nd, the director general of the World Health Organization, quote, I was very impressed by the detail and depth of China's presentation. I also appreciate the cooperation of China's Minister of Health, who I have spoken with directly during the past few days and weeks. His leadership and the intervention of President Xi and Premier Li have been invaluable in all the measures they have taken to respond to the outbreak. Praising China more than a month after they knew from doctors on the ground that an outbreak had occurred while covering it all up. And the WHO doing the Chinese communist dirty work for them. But everybody knew. Everybody knew. Well, what was Joe Scarborough doing during January? Was he putting together this timeline? Is he reporting on the details that everybody knew? No. He was where the rest of the D.C. press corps was, focused on doing his part to aid the effort by congressional Democrats to impeach and remove President Trump from office. That's what he was doing. And as Harsanyi points out, as far as I can tell, in the entire month of January, Morning Joe didn't reference the coronavirus once to his 2.5 million followers on Twitter. Imagine the thousands of lives Scarborough could have saved if he had only shared his insight, because if everybody knew, that necessarily includes Joe Scarborough and everybody. By contrast, on January 31st, President Trump shut down travel from China to this country. Oh, and actually, that document that Nancy Pelosi tore up is full of untruths. You know, the State of the Union address, February 4th, just a few days later, after the president made his decision, he spoke about coronavirus. From the president's State of the Union address, the potential for widespread transmission of the virus by infected individuals seeking to enter the United States threatens the security of our transportation system and infrastructure and the national security. Given the importance of protecting persons within the United States from the threat of this harmful communicable disease, I've determined it's in the best interest of the United States to take action to restrict and suspend the entry into the United States as immigrants or non-immigrants of all aliens who are physically present within the People's Republic of China. And so on. What was Pelosi doing on January 31st, on February 4th? January 31st, she was condemning his travel ban, along with Biden and the rest of the Democrats, as xenophobic. Issuing statements calling Senate Republicans accomplices to the president's cover-up, meaning the cover-up related to his impeachment, not the cover-up related to the coronavirus. She was gloating that President Trump is impeached forever, for all time, throughout the annals of history, no matter what he does, no matter his forthcoming acquittal in the Senate. That's what they were doing. Everybody knew, President Trump knew, and he dithered. Now, we talked about this yesterday with James Copeland from the Manhattan Institute. Were there mistakes made by the Trump administration in February? Yeah. The big one was waiting too long to allow CDC to exercise command control over testing, which CDC wanted. CDC experts wanted. You know, the experts President Trump doesn't listen to, except of course he does, as he has throughout his presidency. In point of fact, he may float some trial balloons that alarm certain quarters, the non-blue check mafia, the blue check mafia on Twitter. But back in the real world, to the extent they can devote this sort of attention span, what you see repeatedly is him assenting to the advice and counsel of experts, whether it's on the sequencing of particular political initiatives, like doing Obamacare versus first before border wall funding, when in his first 2 years he enjoyed Republican control of both chambers of Congress. That was a decision. He acquiesced to Mitch McConnell on that. Like troop levels in certain theaters of war, where he'd like to bring the troops home faster than some of the military advisors and leadership wants to. And like in this case, on any number of occasions, to his infectious disease experts, Drs. Birx and Fauci. Mm-hmm. But everybody knew. Well, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx didn't know, didn't seem to. And remember what Dr. Fauci said with respect to his assessment of the administration's response. The testing thing notwithstanding, because, of course, Fauci, as a CDC guy, is not going to hit the CDC. But just to finish my thought, 4,000 tests done in 3 weeks by the CDC when they were command controlling it. In the 3 weeks after Roche got FDA approval for their test, 1.1 million tests done in the 3 weeks in March. Central planning, capitalism. Public sector, private sector. So, yes, not this thing hasn't been done perfectly. No one could do it perfectly. There's just a lot of people, political hacks like Joe Scarborough and a couple of governors and a couple of mayors that are pretending with 2020 hindsight that they could have done it perfectly, even as they don't believe in such things as the private sector, at least a private sector that is untethered from government centrism. Remember what Fauci said to Mark Levin just as a week ago?
Dr. Fauci, let me ask you a question. You've been doing this a long time. Have you ever seen this big of a coordinated response by an administration to such a threat, a health threat?
Well, we've never had a threat like this, and the coordinated response has been, there are a number of adjectives to describe it. Impressive, I think, is one of them.
Fauci's impressed, but Scarborough isn't. Who's the expert we're supposed to defer to again? Scarborough? Everybody knew, says Joe Scarborough. More on this topic after this message. Roxanne,
Roxanne. Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and I'm still pounding away at Joe Scarborough's. Everybody knew in early January this was coming. Joe Scarborough had a handle on the whole thing. Didn't mention it. Didn't talk about it in January. Everybody knew. Doctors Fauci and Birx didn't know. And, by the way, I will say again, administration after administration, Republicans and Democrats in Congress over generations, report after report, dating back to the 90s, as we talked about earlier in the week with John Solomon's investigative reporting, Paul Miller's piece about the 2004 report from the National Intelligence Center, the 2011 report, which we'll talk about with our Air Force Colonel Larson at the top of the next hour, all talking about the things the federal government needs to do to prepare for a pandemic, the kind of devastation a pandemic of a certain order could bring to bear on America. The post H1N1 task force that called for the replenishment of the N95 masks after 100 million were used to treat in treatment of 60 million Americans who got H1N1 in between 2009 and 2010. Didn't happen. So you can play cheap shot partisan politics like everybody knew Scarborough. Or you can say, for too long, we haven't learned the lessons from previous pandemics of what we need to do in terms of point of care diagnostic testing, in terms of the development of antivirals and vaccines, and in terms of the necessary medical personnel, particularly in a surge situation, and how we're going to game plan that and address it. And try to answer some of those big questions. And you know what? No matter how many smart people you get around a table, the best in the world, as America has at present and has had for a long time, you're not going to be able to predict everything that may come, most likely. So then it's a question of resiliency and adaptability in real time. That's really the standard, isn't it? So everybody knew. Well, did everybody know in New York, since that's the epicenter of the outbreak? I don't think so. We've mentioned it before, but I'll mention it again. And this is not to impute this. These are not, political fellow travelers of mine. But it's not to impugn them. And I want to make that clear. I'm not taking a cheap shot at the New York City Public Health Commissioner Osiris Barbeau. Or even the Sandinista mayor, Bill de Blasio, who I otherwise find an anathema to a free society, because he is. But listen to what they said, a little refresher, because everybody knew, according to Joe Scarborough.
For coronavirus is low, and that our preparedness as a city is very high. There is no reason not to take the subway, not to take the bus, not to go out to your favorite restaurant, and certainly not to miss the parade next Sunday. I'm going to be there.
That was a little more than a week before the St. Patrick's Day parade, which seems like a lifetime ago because every day is a lifetime in this pandemic. But that's a few weeks ago that Dr. Barbeau was saying that. New York City Public Health Commissioner. Everybody knew. Andrew Cuomo asked about, Bill de Blasio asked about his statements over the last several months by Jake Tapper.
So let's talk about the way that you've handled the response in New York City. I want you to take a listen to yourself and your message to New Yorkers. These are three different clips. One's from January, one's from February, and one's from early this month.
It's important. Just go about your lives. Continue living as you have. New Yorkers should go about our lives. Continue doing what we do.
This should not stop you from going about your life. Should not stop you from going to Chinatown and going out to eat.
We want people still to go on about their lives. We want people to rest assured that a lot is being done to protect them.
That last clip was from March 13th, just about 2 weeks ago. In retrospect, is that message, at least in part, to blame for how rapidly the virus has spread across the city?
You know, Jake, we should not be focusing, in my view, on anything looking back on any level of government right now.
Sure. Tell that to Joe Scarborough and the Everybody Knew crowd. You want to talk about propaganda? Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, she was on the Today Show. She's one of, actually, when you get past, I don't even know, maybe Inslee, Washington State Governor. I don't know who's at the top of President Trump's hit list right now, but in terms of politicians saying the most ridiculous things, both locally, infantilizing their population, and then nationally to try to ascribe generations and administrations of negligence, arguably, to the last, to a window of the last 90 days of President Trump's administration. Lori Lightfoot is right at the top of the list.
I will tell you that I don't pay a lot of attention to the things that come out of the president's mouth in his daily briefings. Many of them are not based on fact or science and are just wildly wrong. And that's wrong in this case. If you look at the governors in the states where the virus first hit in this country, those governors, including mine, were very proactive, very aggressive in making sure that we were doing everything that we could to keep people safe. So the president's just wrong about that. I will tell you, been disturbed by the states that still don't have a universal stay-at-home order. Luckily, they don't border ours.
I'm sure those of you living in states not named Illinois are very interested in the views of the mayor of the city of Chicago. I'm sure you'll take those to heart. Give those the consideration they deserve. It's wrong to play the everybody knew game with any of the Democrat mayors. It's wrong to suggest, well, maybe New York didn't jump on this as quickly as it could have. It's wrong to play that game with them, but it's fine to play the same game in the direction of President Trump, you see. You just heard from de Blasio and Barbeau. That's 6 weeks after Trump shut down travel to China. That's January 21, the first case, Washington State. That's more than 3 weeks after Washington State. And oh, by the way, that's 8 weeks, January 21 to March 20th, before Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot issued their shutdown order. Well, it took you 8 weeks. Everybody knew. Everybody knew. How come it took you 8 weeks? Why don't you jump right on it? You could see everything that was coming. You were well aware of it, so you say. Don't listen to what President Trump has to say. Blah, blah, blah. It's not based on science. Really? He's listening to what Fauci and Birx are saying. Are they based in science? The arrogance of these politicians. And of course, Chicago's the epicenter of the arrogance of politicians. The worst outbreak in the country, even though New York State, along with Washington State, California, some of the first states to see cases, New York State and New Jersey still account for more than half of the overall cases in the nation. But nobody is allowed to question the New York response because they're Democrats and because some people are entertained by Andrew Cuomo's daily press briefings. That's the standard, huh? Everybody knew. Yeah, okay, Joe.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. At last night's task force briefing, President Trump asked about a Bloomberg story that broke in the afternoon that, to only the surprise of the New York Times' Tom Friedman, the numbers that the Chinese communists were putting out about the outbreak in Wuhan in terms of total number of cases and total deaths are inaccurate. Shocking. Prior to this U.S. intelligence estimate, there was reporting from Asia Free Press that the number of deaths in Wuhan wasn't 3,300, more like 42,000, according to Wuhan residents. There was also a report that British intelligence put the number of cases at 40 times the 80,000 that was reported, 40 times, so more like 3.2 million. We didn't get details on what U.S. intelligence estimates are, but President Trump nonetheless responded thusly, trying to balance his understanding of the Chinese communist propagandists with his interest in Chinese market for American producers.
I'm wondering if you received an intelligence report that talked about the discrepancy in the numbers, and if you addressed that with
President Xi. We have not received that, but their numbers seem to be a little bit on the light side, and I'm being nice when I say that, relative to what we witnessed and what was reported. But we discussed that with him, not so much the numbers as what they did and how they're doing. And we're in constant communication with I would say the biggest communication is myself and President Xi. The relationship's very good. We have, look, they're spending, they will be spending when things even out. This is obviously a little bit of a hurdle, what's happened over the last month. But they'll be spending $250 billion buying our product, $50 billion to the farmers alone, $200 billion to other things. They never did that before. So we have a great trade deal, and we'd like to keep it. They'd like to keep it, and the relationship is good. As to whether or not their numbers are accurate, I'm not an accountant from China.
President Trump, not an accountant from China, understood. Our friend Bill Gertz over the Washington Times had this exclusive yesterday about a man that he terms the Batman of Wuhan, a key researcher who was involved in Chinese government research that isolated more than 2,000 new viruses, including deadly bat coronaviruses, and carried out scientific work on them, these viruses, just 3 miles from a wild animal market identified as the epicenter of the pandemic. He also reports Chinese officials have refused to provide samples of its coronavirus strains to U.S. researchers. Also did not allow international disease specialists to visit Wuhan for weeks. We know that, in addition to the timeline of the lies. We also know that they're kick out U.S. journalists from the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times. So they're not interested in anybody snooping around, and that obviously is suspicious. And there's also some other matters that, as we look back at our relationship with China over the last several years and some incidents that haven't gotten a lot of attention that are getting renewed attention. But let's pick it up there with Josh Philip, who's a senior investigative reporter from the Epoch Times and the host of the China Report. Josh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, real pleasure. Some big topics to talk about.
Yeah. Now, Epoch Times had reported, and we mentioned it on the show, the decline in cell phone subscriptions since the outbreak of the virus in China at a scale of 20 million. Not necessarily saying that there are 20 million people that have disappeared, that there's 20 million deaths associated with the virus, but it's very curious. And it's consistent with the idea that the Chinese communists are doing something to suppress information, to suppress communication, and to suppress any outsiders from coming inside.
It's an important data point. And the fact is, we're just not getting a hold on the data points out of China. It's 21 million fewer cell phone accounts. Keep in mind that the numbers were rising month by month, not dropping. And during the same time last year, they also rose. In China, you can't just get rid of your cell phone account. It's tied to your social security number. You have to register a facial ID to get it. Right now in China, you cannot even travel around without a cell phone account because your health code is tied to your cell phone account. A green health code means you can travel. A red health code means you cannot travel. And so the Chinese Communist Party is using cell phones for this right now. In February, when they made kids stay home from school, a lot of parents had to register new cell phones because all of the school apps run through a cell phone app, and kids need to use that to access the school. And so really, going by the numbers, you should have had an increase, not a decrease, because right now you can't do anything in China. Kids can't go to school. A lot of parents had to register new accounts for their kids. You can't travel without one. And even in general, even before all this, basically, you can't do much in China without a cell phone.
When we come back with Josh Phillip, I want to pick up with a report that has a possible explanation, or at least partial explanation, for the decline in cell phone registrations. More with Josh Phillip, reporter for the Epoch Times and host of the China Report, when we return.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Josh Phillip, reporter for the Epoch Times, host of the China Report. And Josh, there was a report on this cell phone issue that suggested at least a partial explanation in the decline of cell phone accounts. And one was that the number of migrant workers who canceled their work region mobile subscription as the virus prevented them from entering the country after the lunar holidays in China. Migrant workers usually have one subscription for their work location, another for their home region. And so the drop in the number of users is not normal, but when you look at the bigger picture and content in context with the migrant workers, that could help explain at least some of it.
I'm not saying exactly 21 million people died, even if, 10%, 2 million, that's still much higher than what the Chinese Communist Party is reporting. It's true some people do register more than one cell phone account in China. You can have up to 5 accounts. Again, the number should have increased because the Chinese Communist Party is requiring students to have these accounts in order to access their schools, which they need to do. A lot of migrant workers, there's different estimates on whether or not they actually have 2 cell phone accounts because a lot of them don't get paid a whole lot in the first place, and so a lot of them do not register 2 accounts. But even if that were true, the Chinese Communist Party's claims about reopening cities and reopening things, about 90% of them should have been back to work anyways. And so the Chinese Communist Party, it's lying to us either about reopening things, which there have been a lot of mixed reports on, or it's lying to us about the nature of these closed cell phone accounts and what the real death toll is. I believe it's maybe a combination of both of those.
I want to go back to the so-called Batman of Wuhan, as Bill Gertz terms him, this guy named Tian Jinhua, this leader in the bat virus research work that was being done very close to that wet market in question. He lives and works at Wuhan CDC, a few hundred yards away from the Hunan wet market, said one State Department official that spoke to Gertz. He's among the small team in Wuhan that has contributed to China's obsession in recent years with virus hunting and research. And Gertz describes he would go in caves and collect these bat specimens and so forth without any protection. He ultimately self-quarantined after the outbreak, but now he's disappeared. And I know the Chinese communists have much experience in disappearing people, but the importance of this guy who is among those who people are theorizing about being patient zero. We don't know. Nobody said, but the hunt for patient zero, this guy is on the list. This guy's a lead researcher. 2,000 strains of 2,000 new viruses, including bat coronaviruses that they're doing scientific work on. And now this guy disappears. And we can't get straight answers on China about more fatality stats, much less something as potentially sensitive as this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very possible. The Chinese Communist Party was very openly conducting a lot of research on bat coronaviruses. And yes, a lot of that was being done in Wuhan. There's, of course, a China CDC lab, also the P4 lab, not too far from there. And a Miss Xi was one of the largest, was one of the world's major researchers on bat coronaviruses, just happened to be working out of that lab. which itself is only about 20 miles from that Chinese market. And actually, there were a few different whistleblowers who came out of that lab who really didn't get much attention outside of China. A couple of them actually said the virus leaked from the lab. These were whistleblowers from that lab. There was even rumors in China that a young girl who was working at that lab was patient zero. The right. Chinese Communist Party suppressed that news and even deleted her information from the website of that laboratory. And so there's a lot of mixed reporting. The Chinese Communist Party was openly doing research on bat coronaviruses. The P4 lab actually had reports going back to 2015, and they were publishing reports all the time talking about how they created a synthetic virus, which had a bat coronavirus as well as parts of SARS. And they were talking about tests on mice and how it destroyed the lungs of mice, had no cure, and how they were going to start research on primates. And so they were doing that type of research, and it's not uncommon for viruses to leak from labs. I mean, really, it's almost ridiculous that the CDC and the WHO are not taking seriously the idea that this may have come from one of those laboratories, because it really, by all practical means, the wet market narrative is over. Patient zero had no connection with the wet market, at least not the one we've been told about. So where did the virus come from? Somehow the world is just satisfied with not being told an answer on that. And the CDC and WHO don't seem to be interested in looking into it. It's a very bizarre situation.
Here's something else that's bizarre and concerning, and it's the relationship between some of these Chinese researchers and either individual researchers or institutions in the United States. In late November, this is from Yahoo News, in late November 2018, just over a year before the first coronavirus case was identified in Wuhan, Customs and Border Protection agents at Detroit Metro Airport stopped a Chinese biologist with three vials labeled antibodies in his luggage. The biologist told the agents that a colleague in China had asked him to deliver the vials to a researcher at a U.S. institute, and so the customs agents examined the vials. Inspection of the writing on the vials and the stated recipient led inspection personnel to believe the materials contained within the vials may be viable MERS and SARS materials, says an unclassified FBI tactical intel report that was obtained by Yahoo News. The report that was written by the Chemical and Biological Intel Unit of the FBI does not give the name of the Chinese scientist carrying the suspected SARS and MERS samples or the intended recipient in the U.S., but concluded the incident and two other cases like it cited in the report were part of an alarming pattern. Yeah, I'd say so, but an alarming pattern that leads us to where and why is this not more front and center, particularly in the wake of what's happened since November of last year?
Yeah, and that was handled by the FBI's branch that works on weapons of mass destruction, which is very alarming. And now there's an interesting pattern as well with that. If you remember that professor at Harvard, the one who ran the chemistry department at Harvard and who was charged for working for the Chinese Communist Party's Thousand Talents program, he was actually arrested alongside two Chinese nationals, one of whom happened to be a member of the PLA, the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army. The other one was arrested while trying to transfer close to 20 vials of an unknown biological material. We were not told what those vials were. And so going by this Chinese individual trying to smuggle into the United States vials that allegedly contain SARS and MERS, and an individual tied to that Harvard researcher trying to smuggle out 20 vials of an unknown biological materials. I mean, there's some funny business going on right now. And really, I think America needs better answers than what we're being given.
He is Josh Phillips, senior investigative reporter for the Epoch Times and host of The China Report. Josh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, real pleasure. Thank you.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is The Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, and I wanted to return to belittling Joe Scarborough and Mr. Everybody Knew, both in terms of the not looking back, as New York City Mayor de Blasio said, per his pronouncements as recently as a couple of weeks ago, where it was, you know, everything is normal, continue to go about your daily lives. that issue, as well as the cheap shotting, rather than making an assessment about the responsiveness in the moment, how you're adjusting to the reality on the ground and providing support. In other words, living up to your commitments so that those downstream from you, like governors and local officials, can live up to their commitments. Gavin Newsom, governor of California, was on with Jake Tapper, and Jake Tapper, you know, tried to get him to break. Of course, you know, the only reason Democrat governors like Gavin Newsom or anybody is being complimentary of Trump is because, and the Trump administration response and the task force, is because, you know, they're worried about retaliation if they're not. Okay, here's what Gavin Newsom, the Democrat, hard left Democrat, governor of California, said to that.
But let me just be candid with you. I'd be lying to you to say that he hasn't been responsive to our needs. He has. And so as a question, as a sort of an offer of objectivity, I have to acknowledge that publicly. And the fact is, every time I've called the president, he's quickly gotten on the line. When we asked to get support for that mercy ship in Southern California, he was able to direct that in real time. We got 2,000 of these field medical sites that are up, almost all operational now in the state because of his support. And those are the facts. We always want more. I could criticize this or that. At the end of the day, we're just trying to focus on developing a relationship of trust as a matter of course, because there's just too many Americans, 40 million that live in this state, that deserve us to get together and get along.
Sorry, Jake. No dice. Couldn't give you what you wanted. Now take a break from these mindless, stilted cable news shows, news in quotation marks, and so many of these insufferable anchors. You know what you can do? Check out something that will be food for your mind, that will be morally edifying. No Safe Spaces is now available to watch for a limited time only at nosafespaces.com. This is the number one political documentary of 2019, and it's available to watch at home. Hollywood has done a good job of keeping it off the streaming services because it has valuable content for the free-thinking citizen. This is the documentary produced by our friend Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla that reveals how America has become a dangerous place to speak your mind and share ideas. They present the problem in an entertaining and provocative way, including with the contributions of thought leaders from across the political spectrum, the Jordan Petersons of the world, as well as the Alan Dershowitzes of the world. No Safe Spaces has a 99% audience rating on RottenTomatoes.com. That's the highest rating for any film in 2019. So check it out, because it's available to watch at home right now for a limited time at NoSafeSpaces.com.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. I want to play the Joe Scarborough Everybody Knew game again. Joe Scarborough yesterday haranguing the president. I mean, you got to watch MSNBC a little bit to hear some of what's being said in certain quarters that represents a certain percentage of the population. Scarborough, in setting up his discussion with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, said this.
Nobody could have seen this coming. The fact is, everybody saw this coming. Everybody saw this coming in early January. So
everybody saw it coming. Everybody knew. But Joe Scarborough, he's everybody. He would be included in everybody. And he didn't say or do anything. How could he not say or do anything if he knew? He has a platform. Yeah, I mean, should he be investigated for colluding with the Chinese communists? Because he obviously knew. He just said he knew, and he did nothing. What was he doing? Oh, right. He was flacking for congressional Democrats as they were in the middle of attempting to impeach and remove President Trump from office. But everybody knew. Here's the thing about Joe Scarborough. He's right, but not on his timeline. He's right on the timelines we've discussed on the show before. The 2004 report by the National Intelligence Center modeling out what a pandemic could do to America in comparison to its preparedness. He's right in terms of the post-H1N1 task force that call for the number of N95 masks that were used during that outbreak, 100 million, to be replenished in the national stockpile. He's right going back to the 90s, reports from various agencies. And this is the investigative journalist work of John Solomon over at Just the News, where you have various experts in relevant fields signaling the same warnings that were signaled in that 2004 report. And there was a good piece by Paul Miller from Georgetown on that report that we discussed. Randy Larson, writing in National Review, makes the point as well. During the past several decades, many of my colleagues in the biosecurity and public health communities, plus a bipartisan group of political leaders, have argued to include public health as a key element in national security. Unfortunately, most national leaders fail to listen. He mentioned specifically a 2011 report on three key areas identified by senators. This is Bob Graham, formerly a former senator of Florida, Jim Talent, former senator of Missouri, in the WMD Center report card in, again, 2011, the things that we should be doing. We didn't do them. So this is many presidential administrations, hundreds upon hundreds of members of Congress from both parties over generations. And the effort by these shameless historical revisionists to suggest everything that should or shouldn't have been done can all be concentrated from, you know, January 1 to the present is obscene. So don't play the Joe Scarborough game of just going tit for tat. Why didn't Obama replenish the N95 masks? Why didn't Trump take testing away from the CDC and energize the private sector sooner in February? Don't play the cheap shotting game. Play the historical context game so that we just do the planning that's required now as we at the point at which we get through this and then actually do the resource allocation to implement the planning on a go-forward basis for the next viral outbreak, because there will be a next one. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by the author I was just citing, Randy Larson, who is a retired Air Force colonel, former national security advisor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, host of the upcoming podcast series, A Good War, featuring stories of public health heroes, past and present. Randy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, happy to be with you.
Wanted to go to that 2011 report that you cited in your piece in National Review and sort of the three buckets of things that we should do per that report that we didn't do, at least not to the extent that we needed to.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. I was the lead author of the report. Of course, Senator Graham, Senator Talent, a Democrat, a Republican, were our leaders. It was very bipartisan, and it's still sort of used as the gold standard. The problem is, I think our serious leaders have not put us in a position to be prepared to respond. And that first one is the rapid diagnostics. I mean, that is step one. Now, I'm not a physician. I'm not a public health expert, but I've been at the Center of Health Security at Johns Hopkins there for 15 years, and my role is the National Security Advisor. And I look at this as a national security perspective, which I really enjoyed listening to your last guest, Josh. But we got to talk about this now, because you have no situational awareness. That's what a general refers to on the battlefield. You got to know what's going on around you. We don't have that because we were so far behind in the testing. But things are changing on that is the good news. I have a relative who was ill, and they gave him the strep test, which is instant, practically instant. They gave him the flu test, no. So then they gave him the COVID-19 test, the early one that CDC. 5 days later, we're still waiting for the results. That is just crazy. Now, they're getting in the field right now where we're going to have near real-time testing to see who's got the virus. That's going to be a big game changer. The other one was talked about yesterday in the White House press briefing is a test that will look for antibodies. Personally, that's the one I would like to have. I think I may have already had it. I was sick about 5 weeks ago. Not too bad. but certainly had some sort of viral infection. But if I could go get that simple test, and it's no more difficult than what, you know, you take a blood test to see your blood level, sugar, just a little stick in the finger. If we could find out that I have the antibodies of COVID-19, that means I don't have to sit around the house and just write articles. I could be standing at the front door of hospitals, checking people in, taking their temperatures, because I'd be safe. So those are the two tests that are coming. And next week, the week after, the question is, how quickly can we mass produce them? The technology has been approved by the FDA. They're being made. It's going to be a game changer during the month of April. I can't give you a hard timeline. I can say in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to have so much more situational awareness, which is what our political leaders at the federal, state, and local level need to make informed decisions. Should we keep this city locked down? When can we let a few people start going back to work? So maybe we can start saving the economy. And my heart goes out to so many people that are out of work right now. We've got to figure out how to get it restarted, the economy, but we can't do that until we have the situational awareness. That's where we got behind the power curve. Second big point. Okay,
well, just hold on to this. So Dr. Birx yesterday at the briefing made mention of this, and she sort of put out a clarion call to universities to aid in the development of the antibody testing, the way that the private sector, the pharma companies have aided in the development of the COVID point of care diagnostic testing, like with Abbott now distributing their tests. And so she seemed to be like saying, like, you know, by week's end, which is, you know, 48 hours, she seemed to really be pressing to get this online, as you're suggesting.
And then it was interesting when Dr. Fauci stepped up to the microphone and he said, that's our first priority. And I understand. Believe me, in a military situation, the top leaders have got to figure out what the priority is. I understand that Dr. Fauci doesn't want the antibody test to be the top priority, but boy, I hope it's really close second place, because both of those tests are needed, and they're coming from two different sources. So game changer.
Yeah, why would you need to sequence them? You could do them in parallel fashion.
I completely agree with you, and I'm not sure why Dr. Fauci said it wasn't our top priority. Why aren't both of them priorities? Because they're coming from different production methods, so and sources and organizations. So, like I say, I think that's critical. I'm not going to question Dr. Fauci, because right now he's the best thing we have in the U.S. government to protect our families, I'm telling you.
When we come back with Colonel Randy Larson, I want to address the judiciousness of the shutdowns. More with Randy Larson, former national security advisor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and host of the upcoming podcast series, A Good War, featuring stories of public health heroes, past and present, when we return.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Colonel Randy Larson. Colonel Larson, I wanted to ask you about the shelter-in-place orders. Are we overreacting at the state level with these orders?
Simple answer, no. All the models say that's what we have to do. Now, being a military man, I will also say all models are wrong, but some are useful. And
right.
Why most time we say models are wrong, because, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. We got a lot of bad information early on from the Chinese, and they have hurt a lot of people. And when we do the hot wash, when this is all over and go back and look at everything, it's going to be incredible about the damage done by them holding back all the information till what, January 21st, when they finally said, oh, this may go human to human. So, yeah, we're behind, but we're catching up rapidly, thankfully, for the might of Americans' private sector and getting them involved. I wrote a study in 2015 at Johns Hopkins called Jumpstart, and I talked about the Defense Production Act, and I said, in a big crisis like this, the president has enormous power, how he can take over an industry and say, you know, Johnson & Johnson, stop making, you know, your anti-cholesterol drug and make this. The president can do wage and price controls under the Defense Production Act. It's enormous amount of stuff that we spent time looking at. So I understand President Trump's been a little bit hesitant to really jump in with that, saying, well, we just want the private sector to volunteer to do this. And that's good until General Motors, I guess there were some problems with negotiation and whatever. President Trump just lost his patience finally and said, General Motors, you're going to do this, and here's the price. He has that authority under the Defense Production Act.
With all due respect, people in their lanes, and they get zero focused on the thing that they know how to address real well. But the political leader has to take into account all sorts of other opportunity costs that are being paid. And I just, you know, I'm glad to see any politician exercise any restraint in these moments, because every incentive is to overreact, because in Tony Fauci's world, there's no such thing as an overreaction, and there's going to be no political consequences for overreaction. So you might as well. But in resisting the calls for nationalization of industry, or even the heavy arm of government telling GM what they're going to do, I'm glad to see that, because you know how power creeps. And you set precedents of governments coming in, our government coming in and nationalizing an industry or being heavy-handed with industry that's otherwise being generally cooperative, then it's very easy for politicians to define crises down and invoke these same powers where they're not legitimate.
Actually, President Harry Truman tried to do that.
And the Supreme Court stepped in.
It went to the Supreme Court, Youngstown Sheet 2 versus Reynolds, and the Supreme Court said, Harry,
exactly.
Korea is a police action. It's not a war. It's not a national crisis. So there is a check on the president's power. And the Defense Production Act scares me. I agree with you, Dan. I don't like one person to have that much power, except in a national crisis. But his power can still be checked by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so,
fair enough.
And it's been done before. Okay, can we talk about the vaccines and therapeutics?
Please.
Really big game changer here.
And I'm just telling you,
I wrote the article, it's frustrating, but forget about a vaccine for at least 18 months from now.
Right.
But
talk about antivirals.
A lot of great therapeutics. A lot of antivirals out there. The one they're talking about, hydroxychloroquine, I took it 51 years ago in Vietnam. You know, not a lot of side effects for an 18-year-old kid, but it's could be the game changer, but there's many others. We're also looking at monoclonal antibodies where someone who's recovered from the disease draws some products out of their blood, use it for others. You know, that's what we did before there were antibiotics. So there's many things that are really being tested at a very rapid pace. The one we're going to get the quickest is therapeutics, and that could be measured in months. By summer, we could have some significant things there. And surge capacity at the hospital. Now, I understand at your convention center in Chicago, they're building a 3,000-bed hospital. Did I get that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, McCormick Place.
If you ask the Army Corps of Engineers to come to your city and build something like the hospital, they will do it. But the question we've been asking at the center at Johns Hopkins for years is, yes, people can build pop-up hospitals, but where are the pop-up doctors, nurses, and medical technicians? They're not there. We don't even have enough of them in our current hospitals. Go ahead, Amy.
Colonel Larson, what about retired doctors and nurses being called back to help?
Yeah, it's a handful. I wrote a book in 2007 called Our Own Worst Enemy. A study we did in Texas showed that there were 40,000 nurses who were no longer working in nursing. You know, they got burned out for that, whatever, and they did other things, selling real estate, whatever. I thought that would be a great reserve corps, this you know, we could have a couple weekends a year where we did just a little training and organization, and a crisis we could call them. Unfortunately, nothing like that exists. And yeah, you can ask for volunteers, and you'll get a few retirees coming back, perhaps. Oh, retirees, that's the age group like me who are most at risk of this. So I don't think you're going to man a 3,000-bed hospital. And now there's a big debate going on because the mayor of Los Angeles says that they want to have COVID patients come into those temporary facilities. New York has said no, but now they're questioning it. And I'm not sure about Chicago, whether it's just going to be for which one are you going to use there?
Well,
and
yes, that's correct. McCormick Place is being used to house patients with mild to moderate symptoms, 3,000 beds.
Okay, so they are going to allow COVID patients in there. And, you know, when they say mild, one of the strange things about this disease is that you can go from moderately sick and suddenly in less than 48 hours, it's a spike to very severe. So
I'm just not sure
what those hospitals are going to do.
Well, and going back to the personnel issue, this is a good point. And this is also something else that should be in the postmortem of the outbreak. Regulations, the regulations that are being relaxed, at the state level, like Massachusetts Governor Baker did, allowing out-of-state doctors who aren't needed in their home states to come in and help in Massachusetts, because there are regulations that prohibit a doctor in Illinois from practicing medicine in Indiana. And those sorts of regulations that inhibit, you know, rallying resources to the areas of crisis should be examined, too.
Now, why haven't we fixed that, Dan? We had that problem in Katrina.
There you go.
When a busload of doctors came from Atlanta, Georgia to help them out, and they got turned around because of stupid laws like that. One of the other things that Dr. Eric Toner at our center at Johns Hopkins has been working on for a year, he's an ER doc, is reduced standards of care. So, you know,
right.
Let's say we bring in that retired nurse or a nurse that hasn't worked in 20 years. Now, we got to protect them, their liability or whatever, and said, well, is it okay to have a nurse that hadn't really practiced in a while? Well, I'll tell you what, if you're really sick and the choice of who's going to care for you is a nurse who hadn't worked in 20 years or me, you should be hopeful that, or thankful that you would be getting someone who was at least at one time trained to be a nurse. So we have to look at those reduced standards of care. And I was not aware that Massachusetts was going to have to take special action.
They did take special action.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. No, I mean, it goes back to the thing again, all the lessons we haven't learned over the last several decades, despite all the reports and all the experience. It's very frustrating. So perhaps we'll learn them this time. Colonel Randy Larson, a retired Air Force colonel, former National Security Advisor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, host of the upcoming podcast series, A Good War, featuring stories of public health heroes past and present. Colonel Larson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Jobless claims this week, 6.6 million new filers for unemployment. That, if you exclude last week's jobless claims number, that would be 10x the previous highest weekly total of jobless claims in American history. That's how quick it's gone and deep it's gone that quick. President Trump talking again at his COVID task force briefings about the infrastructure spend he wants to do, but more globally, if you will, talking about in the context of being, you know, America first when it comes to spending tax dollars.
It's time that we spend money on our country. That's what we're going to do. It's time that we start spending on our roads and our bridges and our schools and all of the things that we're supposed to be spending on. And people are finally getting used to it. And you could look at all of what we've done in the Middle East, way back in so many different places, way back in other countries too, by the way. And I've gone to other countries that are very rich. I said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to reimburse us for our costs. They don't even want to know what I'm talking about. It takes them 20 minutes to figure it out because nobody's ever asked them to do that. And they're doing it. They're doing it. And they have no choice. They have to do it. So it's time that we start spending on the USA.
He also seems to be spitballing other things that may be included in a phase four disaster relief bill, even while not committing to one. You know, for example, with respect to restaurants and entertainment.
So we're asking for going back to deductibility where corporations can buy and corporations can go out to lunch and they pay and they get a deduction on what they eat. They get a deduction on the bill. And same with the entertainment. It's going to bring a lot of people back. I think it'll open up the restaurant business. People forget that years ago they had that. And when they got rid of it, when they ended it, for whatever reason, but they ended it, many, many restaurants went out of business. Many entertainment-type facilities went out of business. And now's a great time to bring it back.
Well, I mean, just point of order, the elimination of the write-off for entertainment, corporate entertainment, and the cut on meals from 100% to 50% was part of the 2017 tax cut bill. You know, I don't mean to be uncomfortable on the topic, but it is interesting nonetheless. For more on what should be done to revive the economy amid the pandemic's distress, pleased to be joined by Jonathan Williams, who is the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me back. And as always, greetings from the land of make-believe here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right. Exactly. Right. What did what did Cal Thomas call it? 40 square miles surrounded by reality or something like that.
Exactly right.
So with respect to the big ticket item that President Trump has been talking about for the last couple of days, a $2 trillion infrastructure spend. How do you react to that?
Well, a couple of different ways. I think, you know, if we're going to spend money during this period, which I think is pretty clear based on the CARES Act and stimulus 1, 2, and 3 already coming through Capitol Hill and going to the White House, is there's a appetite to do unanimous consent and spend trillions more to try to get things turned around. I think, you know, part of the idea here is that with infrastructure, at least you're getting something tangible for it versus, you know, perhaps some of the other areas of spending that you're not, you know, bailing out certain industries like airlines and then government taking an ownership stake in the last CARES bill was pretty problematic from a free market perspective. And so if infrastructure, if we see real needs there, you know, maybe this is the time to reevaluate. But I think one of the underlying questions that oftentimes is not asked, as you know, Dan, at the federal and at the state level, is if we're going to spend, how do we spend it most efficiently and get the biggest bang for the buck for the taxpayer out of the deal?
Yeah, and, well, that's true. And I'll tell you what, when we come back, I want to get some alternative ideas since the president seems to be in trial balloon phase right now with what might be included in a phase four. You have written a piece with a colleague about a free market approach to reviving the economy that I think some economists that are near the president, like your Larry Kudlow's and Steve Moore's, would be fairly sympathetic to. More with Jonathan Williams, Executive VP of Policy and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Jonathan Williams, Executive Vice President, that is, of Policy and Chief, and he's also the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, writing in thehill.com, you offer a couple, three ideas that perhaps President Trump and his economic advisors would take under consideration as to ways to jumpstart the economy once we open it back up.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of a different approach than so far we've seen. And most often the reaction to a crisis is how can government do something more? And as we point out in the piece, Reagan had a quip from the 1980s during one of the economic crises where he said, to a staffer, don't just stand there, go undo something. And so we're looking a little bit more creatively at regulations and burdensome laws that perhaps have put a burden on the economy during good times that are extra harmful during times like these with the numbers that we're seeing come out of the economy. So one of the things that was we just talked about transportation, this has a direct relationship to how taxpayers get more bang for the buck, dollar for dollar on transportation funding, is the rule that was passed nearly 100 years ago called Davis-Bacon. And that's something at the federal level that puts prevailing wage requirements, which raises the cost of construction, both for federal projects and then states that take federal dollars, which almost all of them do on the big highway projects, raises the cost by 10, 20, maybe up to 30% of what it would be in a free market scenario. And so some estimates look at this and say, not only could states save a ton and the federal government save a ton of money, we could actually, if that was put to more road construction instead of savings, we could see something like 155,000 new construction jobs. So as we talk about these unemployment numbers coming out that are awfully scary right now, wouldn't that be nice to be able to waive this bureaucracy that's nearly 100-year-old law and actually put that to work for taxpayers instead?
And there's some other sort of hits on your list of things to do that are would be difficult, suspending the Davis-Bacon Act so you don't have to pay prevailing wage for public works projects and those sorts of things. What about on the incentive side? Does it even make any sense at this point to talk about a big either cut or holiday on capital gains? It's an environment where when you're in shutdown, it doesn't matter how much incentive you're providing for capital to be risked because we're in shutdown?
Well, so there's a couple of thoughts on that. And as we point out, there's some tax ideas that I think have gone over fairly well so far that came out of the last package, such as tax filing day going to July 15th from April 15th, such as things like allowing businesses to take net operating losses and carry them back for profitable years to offset the losses that they're going to see this year. So there's some innovative things that we're seeing so far. I mean, I think that it's a very legitimate debate in terms of how do we give either some sort of a holiday on tax collection, a deferral on tax collection at the state and local level, even, with property tax bills coming up for a lot of folks this summer and big lump payments, a lot of people are not going to have cash flow. What if some of the counties and cities looked at ways to deferring those for businesses and individuals? So I think capital gains is an interesting discussion because, obviously right now a lot of people have short-term losses if they've been in the market, but it would give people the incentive to get back into equities perhaps at a good time. Who knows, obviously, where we're going from here, but it certainly would give people more of an incentive to look at equities again.
What about what the Fed did yesterday by easing capital requirements for big banks, removing treasuries and central bank deposits from the calculation to free up banks to replace them in their asset pools with loans to consumers and businesses? Is there much of a market for that at present with most of those businesses, small businesses, fewer than 500 employees, rushing to get their paperwork into the SBA for the money that was made available through the phase three disaster relief?
Well, right. That's going to be huge. I think there's going to be tons of applications pouring in now. And then as independent contractors and the gig economy types go online, I think it's April 10th. With that opening of the window, there is a cap right now on the SBA number. I think Congress has said on a bipartisan basis they want to revisit that and perhaps add more capital there later on if needed. You'd be essentially looking potentially at those over 500 employees. And I think probably the thought was let's give as many lifelines as possible. And obviously liquidity is a big concern for many right now.
And then, you also have the $4 trillion that was part of it that's left to the Fed to work their mysticism well beyond their charter. I mean, it should be noted. But the worry there from economists like Luigi Zingales at the University of Chicago is, at the same time, you're trying to reduce the burdens to credit, like the Fed's move yesterday with capital requirements for big banks, you're crowding out private investment by flooding the debt markets with the Fed, with the funny money the Fed has.
Well, right, and the long term concern obviously there is, you know, what happens to the value of the dollar, what happens to inflation. That's a real long-term concern, obviously, both with the debt the way it is and all this extra liquidity getting pumped in by the Fed. Some of it may be necessary in the short term, but government does not have a great track record, as you know, unwinding these things, as we were just kind of getting to the unwinding stage from the last time we went through this in 2008 with Ben Bernanke and Barack Obama. With a lot of lessons to learn, I think, from 2008 and how things need to be wound up more quickly. And also, I mean, this kind of whole charade over shovel-ready projects and stimulus of bailing out states, for instance, that could be round four. There's a lot of, I think, cautionary tales that we can take from 2008.
How about the modeling, too? I mean, do you think that people have a handle? I mean, with the 6.6 million jobless claims posted today, you think people are really have a full appreciation for the damage that's being done on a daily basis to this shutdown, to our economy by the shutdown?
I don't think so. I mean, these are unprecedented times, as you pointed out. If it wouldn't have been for last period, we'd be looking at 10x the number of unemployment claims, as you pointed out. And, you look at Goldman Sachs projections of second quarter GDP, which is obviously looking into a crystal ball still at this point. But, I mean, they're looking at it in the range of -25%, which would dwarf any previous quarter of negative GDP growth. And it's really difficult, I think, for most people, even economists, I think, to grasp the gravity of the situation right now.
Jonathan Williams, Executive Vice President of Policy, Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Joe Biden from his Delaware compound on with Brian Williams of MSNBC. I call this Two Fabulous Fictions. If you believe my lies, I'll believe yours should be the caption. Asking was Brian Williams, Joe Biden, about what form the November election will take in terms of, you know, voting.
Here's one of the ways this coronavirus impacts on politics. Can you really envision every prominent Democrat in this country from all 50 states inside a hot arena 104 days from now?
I can smell it from here.
It's hard to envision that. Again, we should listen to the scientists. And, you know, one of the reasons why the Democratic convention was going to be held early was the Olympics were coming after the Republican convention. There is more time now. I think we're going to, again, we ought to be able to. We were able to do in the middle of the Civil War all the way through to World War II.
Yeah, it talks about doing it virtually, which I like. I like the idea of because it really gives it that Orwellian feel that would be so appropriate. And then on in terms of mail-in ballots, so, you know, the left can do their ballot harvesting programs that proved so successful in the midterms, places like Orange County, as well as drive-through voting, Joe Biden said.
You know, the House talked about some of this, and the president said, well, if we did what the House wanted, we'd ensure no Republican ever got elected. That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And so this is about making sure that we're able to conduct our democracy while we're dealing with a pandemic. We can do both. It may mean a difference in the way we do it. It may mean that social distancing doesn't get it done. It may mean that you have a circumstance where you have drive-in voting, literally, you pull up and you have vote. There's a lot of ways to do it, but we should be talking about it now.
Yeah, well thought out as usual, coherent, specific. Maybe this could be a conversation, since Joe Biden wants to talk about it now, that he has when he calls him maybe Trump.
Joe Biden would be open to having a phone call with you to talk about the coronavirus pandemic.
That's okay, sure.
Would you take his call?
Oh, absolutely.
You would talk to him about it.
I'd love to speak to him, sure.
He should be able to work together. I always have him to be a nice guy. I don't know him very well, frankly, but I think he's probably a nice guy. No, if he'd like to call, I'd absolutely take his call. Okay.
Okay. All right. Great. We'll let Carly Rae Jepsen know that the call may be coming. What is coming, what is available right now for a limited time only, an opportunity to watch No Safe Spaces. That's the Dennis Prager, Adam Carolla documentary that illustrates how America is exceptional, shows how our foundational American values are under attack on college campuses and social media platforms, of course, in Hollywood, but also how you can fight back. It's a must-see for any American, young or old. And though the institutional interests have prevented No Safe Spaces from being featured on one of the streaming services, it is being made right now for a limited time only at nosafespaces.com. So take advantage of this downtime at home to check out Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla and a cast of contributors talking about free minds and free speech in a free society at nosafespaces.com.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com. It's where you can find podcasts, as well as you can find them on iTunes and Spotify. Also on social media, at Dan Proft Show, both on Facebook and Twitter. Interesting survey out yesterday. Axios poll surveying 1,355 adults and getting respondents to answer questions about COVID-19 impact on their lives, particularly their livelihoods. 15 to 20% of the respondents in the lower three tiers, so middle income and lower, said they had either been furloughed or their company had closed down. Almost all of the members of the upper two tiers were able to work as normal or adjust and simply work from home. Axios reports the survey finds Americans with less education and lower incomes far more likely either to have to keep showing up at their workplaces or more likely to have seen their work dry up. And yet, this other result. Nearly 50% of the respondents in the upper two tiers said their emotional well-being had gotten worse, while only one in three members of the lower three tiers said the same. So the lower three tiers are being disproportionately hammered and their economic security jeopardized. They feel less emotionally distraught about it than the upper two tiers who are not being impacted other than, you know, perhaps in their trading accounts. It's really interesting because it speaks to this new class war argument that Michael Lind and others are making, that it has very little to do with ideology and much more is it a divide along education. And that dovetails nicely with this really compelling piece from Forward.com that I mentioned on my show in Chicago the other morning, but I wanted to share it with you and happy to have the author of the piece on, The Huge Gap Between the Media and the American People. It's a review of Ezra Klein's new book, Why We're Polarized, Ezra Klein over at Vox.com, the sort of the new left. But I think it flies in formation with some of the other arguments about the real divisions in this country aren't what the media suggests they are, both in terms of nature as well as depth. Pleased to be joined now by Bhatia Ungar Sargon, who's the opinion editor at Forward.com. Bhatia, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed your piece and your review of Ezra Klein's book. I haven't read the book yet. Maybe I don't need to, frankly, after reading your piece. But he starts from a well-worn premise that we're more polarized than ever, Ezra Klein does in his book. And you sort of look both at follow the logical thread that the arguments he's making, as well as some polling data that seems to undermine the arguments that he's making about just how polarized we are as compared to how the media reports we are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's this sort of narrative out there that you hear all the time that we've never been more polarized. And I just don't think that the polling suggests that the American people is. In fact, the opposite. We've actually never been as united as we are right now around major issues like civil rights and equality. But at the same time, as Americans, you know, the average Americans have become more and more united over these major issues, institutions like the media and our politicians have gotten more and more divided and more polarized. What I think is happening is instead of them being out there representing us, they are kind of dragging us onto the front lines of their wars and their fights that are about, you know, their interests, the media's interests as a class or the politicians' interests as a class, and forcing us to represent them and fight for them instead of the other way around.
Yeah, and this this line that where you undermine the central premise of Klein's book, as far as I'm concerned, the idea that politics is about identities rather than ideas or policies is Klein's central thesis. And what you find is that, as you're sort of describing, okay, so now Ezra Klein wants to drag me onto the battlefront to argue about pronouns. I'm not really interested in arguing about pronoun usage. I'm more interested in my economic security, physical security interests, the education of my children. So that's what I want to hear politicians talk about to the extent I devote any mind share to them at all.
And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, I like to say I'm old enough to remember when the left used to make fun of, you know, white working class people for not voting in their economic interests, right? You remember
right.
that book, What's the Matter with Kansas,
Thomas
right?
Like, Frank.
Why don't
right.
they vote in their economic interests? And now that, you know, before the COVID outbreak, you had the best economy in American history, and people are saying, look, I'm seeing the money. Then now they get on their case for voting in their economic interests.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's difficult to follow. And the other thing that's interesting about this, too, and by the way, I'm not like as a conservative Catholic, I'm a conservative Catholic, so I'm not necessarily celebrating all the results that you document, sort of where we're
right.
at. But
right.
but I recognize that they're still the results. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, so I understand where people are at and why and some of the reasons why they're there. So it's just that Ezra Klein and so many on the left are describing a world that is not this world in terms of trying.
Yeah.
And so how can you offer prescriptions for this world? You're basically saying this is the world that I want it to be because this is the world that provides the most opportunity for me to sort of browbeat or hoodwink people into my way of thinking.
Yeah, there's, you know, on the one hand, you have sort of this sort of mission creep of a term like racist. Right, which used to refer to actual racism, but now that there's less and less racism, just refers to a whole host of things, like just the fact of a national border, for example, is now considered racist. And so you really see how, you know, the left won this culture war, you know, over sexism, racism, diversity, but they can't stop fighting that fight, and so they pushed the border. And on the other hand, you see that the Democratic Party has become very much a party of elites, very much representing professional elites, like you were saying, the people who are all still employed right now. And at the same time, you had, you know, the Trump administration really pursuing a lot of sort of protectionist policies that used to be the left's bread and butter that had been abandoned by the left, right? And he's sort of embracing this trade war with China and a new NAFTA that's, you know, the best trade policy that, you know, agreement that the United States has ever signed on to, and nobody can talk about it because we expect that to come from the left and not from the right. And I'm sure, you know, as a conservative Republican, you're not thrilled about that economic stuff either.
Right. No, that's right. And go back now to the other side too. Say, you know, I'm old enough to remember back like in the Obama administration, way back then, when they were talking about border security and dealing with illegal
right.
immigration. So it's
right.
you know, so the party, so the Democrats are being remade. Perhaps they're on a trajectory to be remade along some of these fault lines between sort of the squad, if you will, and some of the older, more sort of more institutional Democrats. I mean, Joe Biden was no moderate for most of his career. He just looks like a moderate compared to
right.
the squad at this point. But so there was consensus on some of these issues that are driving the argument that were so polarized just a few years ago, like immigration.
Yeah, 100%. Immigration, I think, is really interesting because it's fascinating. You know, someone like Bernie Sanders in 2015, when asked about open borders, he scoffed in Ezra Klein's face and said, that's a Koch brothers proposal, right? Like that's that he, as a democratic socialist, would never be pro-open borders. Fast forward just 4 years, and he's up there saying, you know, decriminalize illegal border crossing and you know, healthcare benefits for undocumented people. So it's just so interesting to see that flip-flop. And what fascinates me about it is immigration is now the new identity politics. It's sort of been taken up as the kind of this woke left platform, but it actually, the people that it hurts is the people that used to be the Democrats' bread and butter, right? The white working class and the working poor, right? Those are the people who are the most sort of affected by immigration. It's not the people who, like you said, who are at home right now, like me, journalists who are still totally employed despite the fact that people on the bottom third are losing their jobs.
Right. I wonder if there's another dynamic at play here, too, which is that the left wants to, in my opinion, insinuate politics in every corner of our life. Every corner of our life has to have, you know, has to comport with some sort of paradigm of social justice and wokeness. And there was a time where there was a little bit more restraint on both sides, that there are aspects of human existence that don't have to be politicized. And so some of what the what translates into polarization is not so much even a position on a particular issue. It's just, I don't want politics in this space. I want this to be an inviolate space mm-hmm. where politics doesn't mm-hmm. enter.
And I think I think you're right. And I think it's very much related to the loss of religion in on the left, you know, yeah. sort of the sorting where, you know, you have more and more people who are less and less. I mean, of course, this doesn't apply to the African-American community, who is deeply, deeply religious and also therefore much more moderate and but still stalwart Democrats. But I think when you don't have that kind of religion in a way provides that kind of that stuff that makes life meaningful. And when you kind of lead a life without that, you're stuck looking for meaning in other ways. That's kind of, I think, the more cynical reading of it. But there's this amazing book by Tim Carney called Alienated America, mm-hmm. where he argues that the deaths of despair in the communities that are falling apart, the thing that predicts that is not the closing of the factory, but the closing of the church.
She is Bhatia Ungar Sargon. I hope I pronounced that right.
Close enough.
All right. Good. Thank you. Thanks for giving me the benefit of the doubt. She's the opinion editor of the Forward, Forward.com. I will tweet out her piece. Do check it out. Coronavirus exposes the huge gap between the media and the American people. Really good perspective. Bhatia, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. All the best and stay safe out there.
You too. Take care.
Get seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Creepshow Joe Biden has some ideas for the November election. This is always fun when two fabulous can get together like Brian Williams and Joe Biden and swap apocryphal stories. We're going to have a DNC, Uncle Joe? We're going to have a November election? And if so, what should it look like? How should it be administered?
Here's one of the ways this coronavirus impacts on politics. Can you really envision every prominent Democrat in this country from all 50 states inside a hot arena 104 days from now?
It's hard to envision that. Again, we should listen to the scientists.
And, imagine the smell.
You know, one of the reasons why the Democratic convention was going to be held early was the Olympics were coming after the Republican convention. There is more time now. I think we're going to, again, we were able to in the middle of the Civil War all the way through to World War II, have Democratic and Republican conventions and primaries and elections and still have public safety. And we're able to do both. But the fact is, it may have to be different. There may be, my guess is there's going to be a great deal more absentee balloting. We used to call it, but paper ballots that have to be that people choose to use rather than show up and have social distancing. But who knows, by the time we get into July, September, July to begin with, but June, July, August, September, what it's going to look like. We'll have to listen to the scientists. But there's be no rationale for eliminating or delaying the election. It may be virtual.
A little bit more from Biden once he remembered the order of the months of the year. Yeah, it's challenging. On remote voting?
You know, the House talked about some of this, and the president said, well, if we did what the House wanted, we'd ensure no Republican ever got elected. That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And so this is about making sure that we're able to conduct our democracy while we're dealing with a pandemic. We can do both. It may mean a difference in the way we do it. It may mean that social distancing doesn't get it done. It may mean that you have a circumstance where you have drive-in voting, literally, you pull up and you have vote. There's a lot of ways to do it, but we should be talking about it now.
I like the idea of a virtual convention, virtual conventions generally, because it has that added Orwellian effect that I enjoy so much. Perfect. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Pinkerton, co-chair of Rate Coalition, contributor to the American Conservative, and Breitbart. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
What about the idea of a mostly mail-in slash drive-through November election?
As a longtime resident of Chicago, I think it would be a great invitation to vote for us. But frankly, I think it's kind of inevitable. I think that, you know, oftentimes bad policies get, you know, slid in under the name of a crisis, and this is certainly a crisis. And so I think it'll put an enormous premium on verification. If you need an ID card to, you know, get inside an office building or get on an airplane, you ought to have one to have to vote. And I realize that's the crux of the fight now between Republicans and Democrats on this vote fraud issue. But the wind is at the back of those who say that it's too dangerous to be standing in line for, you know, an hour or so, or maybe more, maybe less.
Well, I know it's a bit of an imponderable depending on where we're at, but Stacey Abrams suggested, you know, she's auditioning to be Biden's VP. She said, it's going to, you know, forms. Secretary of State's offices should start moving on this right now. Ask very little information. Make sure everybody gets it, you know, pre-postage paid envelope and so on and so forth. I mean, this is just an invitation to wild ballot harvesting.
Yes, it is. And nobody wanted this to happen, this whole corona crisis. And again, Republicans are going to have to think hard about how to do this in a verifiable way. I mean, in some sense, we have been preparing for this with the rise of the internet and with blockchain and so on. I mean, you know, if Verizon and AT&T know exactly where we all are right now as we speak, you know, on the telephone, on the radio, and they know where all your listeners are as they drive around, it is possible, if we wanted to have a foolproof system here in place. But again, the emphasis is on the quote, if we wanted to, close quote.
You know, it's an interesting conversation to have about the administration elections and so many other areas of our life in America and what they will or won't look like post COVID-19. Because Francis Fukuyama had an interesting piece in The Atlantic, and I don't agree with his assessment of the Trump administration's response, but I do agree with something that he said about the importance of trust. And you were just talking about, you know, what could be designed in our digital technologically advanced world. I'm sure you could have company design a voting system where everybody could vote online from the comfort of their own home. Of course, that's feasible. It's possible. The hurdle is not the technology. The hurdle is the lack of trust in who's building it, who's overseeing it. Is it by? And so one of the topics we have to tackle when it comes to all of this, what does K-12 education look like, and what is a telecommuting, a telehealth look like, and what do elections look like? They're all predicated on trust, and in so many institutions in America, trust has been lost, including institutions in the private sector like big tech, who could provide some of these solutions. So until you can have people in charge that convey a sense of competence and fair play, you're going to have a real problem no matter how you design a system.
Exactly, which is why, you know, organizations like the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, are consciously designed as bipartisan. It's three Republicans, three Democrats on the commission. And, you know, the FEC is not seen as the most effective agency ever. They certainly have a hard time keeping track of, you know, the spending of people like, you know, Governor Pritzker and so on. But they at least offer the glimmer of a system whereby, all right, look, there's an equal number of us in this room, and we have to operate by something resembling a consensus to do anything. And that, I mean, again, if the alternative is, if the Republicans let themselves be in the position of, we oppose mail-in and digital voting and app-based voting and so on, and so then the Democrats say, okay, it'll be Joe Biden, Stacey Abrams, and Google doing it because the Republicans don't want to play, I think that's a very bad outcome.
He is Jim Pinkerton. He is the co-chair of the Rate Coalition, as well as a contributor to the American Conservative and Breitbart. Check out his piece that he was just describing. Coronavirus will bring a new era of borders, walls, distancing, dispersion, and self-defense. Jim, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Per our conversation with Jim Pinkerton, part of thinking about what a post-COVID-19 America looks like is thinking about whether or not we'll still be a society with largely free markets and free minds and free speech. And on the free minds and free speech portion of the program, now is the time to check out No Safe Spaces. No Safe Spaces is the number one political documentary of 2019. This is the documentary put together by our friends Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla that reveals how America has become a dangerous place to speak your mind and share ideas in so many spaces, you know, safe spaces that are unsafe spaces for freedom of thought and freedom of speech, college campuses, social media platforms, of course, Hollywood. It's a sobering reminder that nothing is guaranteed. And if you think or say something the radical left doesn't like, where they're in positions of authority on social media, at work, your place of worship even, they will come for you and try to shut you down or at least shut you up. So take the time now to check out No Safe Spaces at nosafespaces.com. For a limited time only, it is free to stream at nosafespaces.com. Wake me up before you go, go.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. And former Wall Streeter turned shutterbug Chris Arnandi, who we've had on the show, friend of the show, turns out to be a great photojournalist, very interesting, and very focused on poverty in America as his preeminent case studies. Useful Twitter thread yesterday. Looking at early COVID-19 numbers here in the U.S. by geography, it's looking more and more like this is going to hit hardest lower-income Americans, especially minorities, both for total cases and deaths. And, of course, especially for minorities, disproportionately in lower-income brackets. And he goes through a few of the awful reasons why this is so. And, by the way, this speaks to the conversations we've had in the last couple of shows, including with Rich Karlgaard at Forbes, about the social fabric. If it was fraying before COVID-19, in part because of income equality, the distribution of resources between the haves and have-nots, then you can expect that things are going to be very tense as we try to climb out of the economic damage that this has inflicted, and to some extent, I would argue, we've inflicted on ourselves. Arnotti goes on, first, the ability to shelter in place and quarantine. Put simply, there are those who have the luxury and resources to not work or work from home or isolate themselves in well-equipped homes. Others can't. Other people have to go out a lot. Think of it as the laundromat gap. I like that, the laundromat gap. Something that a lot of us don't think about. Certainly I don't, but it's very real for a lot of people. And a lot of people who have underlying conditions as well, because you're talking about people who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. So they're likely to be less healthy, which is sort of interesting because there's so much time spent on providing for those and so much who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale through government. Of course, we should be our brother's keeper, but I'm talking about through government. And the mantra of the left to justify all of their government gambits is poverty kills. And yet they're the number one cheerleader for these sort of complete shutdowns with no real consideration to economic modeling, only public health modeling, as dubious as both are at this juncture. Getting back to their core constituencies here, or those they say are their core constituencies, whether they're actually served in that way or not. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Brad Palumbo, Deputy Contributors Editor at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. Brad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Chris Arnotti's tweets dovetail right into your piece about this new survey from Axios, which I mentioned a bit earlier in the show. But the upshot of it is the poor are getting hit the hardest, as Arnotti is saying, as we've said on the show, as should be obvious to most if you think about it. But it's the rich who feel most emotionally challenged in these times. It's sort of interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I can say I agree with you. It's kind of common sense to think that the poor and working class are going to be hit hardest by the coronavirus shutdown. Because when you think about it, for a lot of white collar workers, I mean, think about myself, I'm a journalist, right? That kind of the educated white collar middle class, it's very easy to work remotely. My job isn't disrupted. I don't work in a restaurant. I'm not going out to laundromats every day, like you mentioned. So the costs of this are, it's affecting everybody, but it's definitely hitting some people worse than others. But what was so fascinating about this survey that I wrote up is that it consistently showed that upper class, rich, and educated Americans are more likely to say they've been emotionally damaged by this. And I just find that really concerning, because you have the people who are better off right now showing this emotional fragility, and then you have the people who are being hit the hardest just kind of toughing it out.
Right.
And I think that's really concerning.
The people being hit the hardest, 1 in 3 say they're, you know, sort of emotionally less well off, as opposed to half of those that are more well off saying they're less emotionally well off, if you follow that. The thing that, you know, they don't have time, the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, they don't have time to navel gaze. They got to go out and survive. Whereas those that have more flexibility and resources, you know, are sitting around trying to sort of emote in solidarity, I think, with those that have less, rather than do things that are a little bit more productive in that direction.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. You have educated workers have a lot of time on their hands to sit around reading the news, and Lord knows that's getting more alarmist by the day. So that's part of the reason that they're more emotionally distressed. But I also would argue, and I argue in my column, that part of the reason is that the upper classes are more likely to have been to college and been in our higher education system. They're more likely to hold progressive worldviews. And these are systems and worldviews that encourage victimhood, that teach people that they are oppressed, and that foster, whether it's safe spaces or trigger warnings, they foster a sense of emotional fragility. And we're seeing the dividends of that when you have the best off people in society, the first to melt down in a crisis and claim emotional damage.
That's a good point. He's Brad Palumbo. He's the contributor editor at WashingtonExaminer.com. When we come back, I want to pick up on this issue of overreaction. If those from the elite strata are so emotionally distraught, doesn't it feed overreaction in response to this crisis? More with Brad Palumbo right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Brad Palumbo. He's the contributors editor at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. And Brad, I want to pick up on the question of overreaction, because I do believe there's such a thing. I know that we're being told that there isn't, but I think there's a lot of obvious examples to suggest otherwise. But a couple of data points to get your reaction to. One, this is New York City COVID-19 deaths. Of the 1,300, this is effective April 1, as of April 1. Of the 1,397 deaths, 18 had no underlying conditions. That's 0.1%. Now, I'm not dismissing the lives of people who have an underlying medical condition, like, oh, you know, come what may. I'm just trying to provide some context here to understand the nature of the threat, the lethality of it. Another data point, Dr. Robert Redfield, the CDC director, tells NPR that an estimated 25% of coronavirus carriers have no symptoms. If you've got a quarter of coronavirus infected that are asymptomatic, then and thus not reflected in the state-by-state stats or the national stats, then we're talking about a lethality rate that starts to trend right down towards about the influenza range. And again, the reaction to this versus the reactions to viruses past and what this might mean to future. Your reaction to my suggestion that there's an overreaction.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough question, right? Because we do clearly have the data showing that this disease is only a threat to certain people, the elderly, people with pre-existing conditions. If you're young and healthy, like you said, I mean, you're talking about a fatality rate of, what, 0.5%, something very minimal, though the numbers are hard to exactly determine because the data is all over the place. So it is a serious problem, but also, I mean, it's a really sticky situation because if we were to just do nothing and just allow it to spread, the real difference between this disease and something like the influenza is that this one just spreads like wildfire, like something we've never really seen. at least in modern memory. And if we were just to do nothing, some of the estimates show as many as 1 to 2 million people could die. So we're shutting down everything. I mean, unemployment claims are up to 6.6 million this week. That's like 10 times the highest ever record.
Right.
And you know what? That comes with its own cost. Unemployment leads to suicides, to divorces, to heart attacks, to anxiety, to stress. These sorts of things can break down a society. So I don't think you're wrong to question the extent of the trade-off of this shutdown, but it's hard to know what this easy answer is. It can't just shut down everything.
Right, and it's not an easy answer, and I know you weren't saying this, but it's also a false choice that's presented by media hysterics and politicians. You either do everything or you do nothing. You either impose martial law or you do nothing. No, of course not. We're saying what is a reason? We have to have conversations about reasonable trade-offs because that's what adults have to do in real life, not in the woozy dream world that these media types live in on the cable box. You make trade-offs. Everything in life is a trade-off, including with respect to freedom versus security. And the idea that we can't even have a conversation about opening up, doing more testing in particular places that haven't shown a significant outbreak to see if it's a little bit safer and start reopening at some regions or some sectors of the economy while still having shelter in place orders for people that are more susceptible to real serious illness as a result of this virus, that we can't have a layered approach to this. We can't have a conversation about a layered approach strikes me as just the madness of crowds.
I agree, and I'm calling in from Arlington, Virginia, just outside D.C. My governor, racist Ralph Northam, the KKK photo fame, he ordered us a shelter-in-place statewide shutdown out till June 10th.
Insane. It's insane.
I understand that we may need such an order right now for the next couple weeks, but we should be reevaluating it with the data and trying to see when are we ready to open things up a little bit in phases with protective steps. This idea that you are just going to blanket shut down all of society pretty much, except the utmost essentials, out through June 10th, that's nuts to me. We don't know what the situation is going to look like. If we've learned one thing through this process, it's that it's really hard to predict what's going to happen, and all the models and data will keep changing. So this idea that we can have this overreaction is a valid point to make because some people just want to completely defer to experts at CDC or in public health, and we should absolutely be listening to them. But we also have to think about other points of view, like trade-offs with economics. There is no easy answer to this crisis.
Well, and the problem, of course, is that there's no disincentive to overreaction. That, you know, you or me, we're going to complain about KKK Northam and that draconian measure. As you say, why put down such a marker? After everything you hear from the experts about modeling and how the models have changed so radically from just a week ago as more data becomes available, why do that? But there's no disincentive to do that because everything is done in furtherance of quote unquote saving lives. It's only what we see, not what we don't see, like we were talking about with suicides or stress-related diseases when you get economically ravaged and the like. And so at the end of this, whatever was done, no matter how over the top, it's going to be, hey, we had to do it to save lives, and we saved so many lives by doing this, and no one will be able to disprove it, so why not?
Yeah, that's the problem, is that you have one side of the equation has very visible, direct results. And the other one has indirect results, so people don't see them as easily, so they're just getting discounted from the decision-making process when what we really need to be doing is doing our best to balance both. And that's all we can ask for our leaders is that they do that. I think you're absolutely right to criticize some of the journalism class and some of the overreactions. I will say it's easy for them to say, shut everything down, when they can still work from at my table right now on my MacBook Pro, and so are all the journalists tweeting about shut everything down. Their salary is still getting direct deposited into their bank account. So it's very easy for the journalist blue check Twitter class to say shut everything down till December, right? Everything, save lives. And I mean, there's truth to the need to save lives, of course. But it's easy for people like them to say, just shut the economy down, because they're not really the ones who would be bearing the repercussions of that.
And then we're going to hear from those very same people how their job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I mean, it's just really something. He is Brad Palumbo. He's the contributors editor at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. Brad, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Don't turn around.
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And, celebrities making, as Chris Arnotti calls them, annoying as frack videos from their mansions, scolding us or doing some half-ass PSA that's patronizing in nature about coronavirus. There are some exceptions, though. There's some exceptions. And Larry David, because I'm a big Curb Your Enthusiasm fan, I know he is a man of the left, like most in Hollywood. But this is pretty good. And I actually believe him when he say he was pressed into duty.
Hello, I'm Larry David. Obviously, somebody put me up to this, because it's generally not the kind of thing I do. But I basically want to address the idiots out there. And you know who you are. You're going out. I don't know what you're doing. You're socializing too close. It's not good. You're hurting old people like me. Well, not me. I have nothing to do with you. I'll never see you. But, you know, other old people who might be your relatives. Who the hell knows? But the problem is you're passing up a fantastic opportunity, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to stay in the house, sit on the couch, and watch TV. I mean, I don't know how you're passing that up. Well, maybe because you're not that bright, but here it is. Go home, watch TV. That's my advice to you. You know, if you've seen my show, nothing good ever happens going out of the house. You know that. There's just trouble out there. It's not a good place to be. So stay home and you know, don't see anyone. Except maybe if there's a plumbing emergency, let the plumber in and then, you know, wipe everything down after he leaves. But that's it.
Okay. No word on whether Latte Larry's will open up after the virus has subsided. But this is something that does get Larry David outside, me too. And I'm sure he would be supportive of, which is golf. And this story about Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson doing a rematch of their Shadow Creek showdown from November of 2018. NFL icons Tom Brady and Peyton Manning will join Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson in a golf match organized by AT&T's Warner Media and the PGA Tour. That was somebody associated with the negotiations, confirming to CNBC. So the matchup is going to be Mickelson and Brady versus Woods and Manning. There you go. And this is going to be to raise money for, you know, some coronavirus relief fund. So the only question is, when does it happen? Because as soon as they're on a golf course, particularly if it's otherwise a shutdown state, then I'm going to use that to petition the officials in my shutdown state to allow me to get back on a golf course too, where we're otherwise locked down till April 30th. And I'm sure Larry David feels the same. Thanks for joining us on another installment of the Dan Proft Show. Please do so again tomorrow.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.